President Obama breaks a leg, Trump stands triumphant, and Ted's Cruz sinks. We're pivoting toward the general election on The Political Junkie. I'm Neil Conan, in for Ken Rudin. Ted Cruz left it all out on the field in Indiana, but he lost and left the race, which makes Donald Trump the presumptive Republican nominee.
Trump has completely eviscerated every shred of conventional wisdom. The term conventional wisdom should be banned from the rest of this election cycle. Completely meaningless.
Plus, we go back 5 years to recall a pivotal moment in Obama's presidency, the raid that killed Osama bin Laden.
Certainly was intelligence and military triumph that happened on his watch. And I think the killing of bin Laden shored up his credentials as a commander-in-chief more than any other single thing he could have done.
And what's it like to write jokes for the president? We'll meet one of the men behind the presidential punchlines.
After the midterm elections, my advisors asked me, Mr. President, do you have a bucket list? And I said, well, I have something that rhymes with bucket list.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 126 of The Political Junkie. I'm Neil Conan, filling in this week for Ken Rudin, who's been recovering from an illness. Last week, Donald Trump set out the stakes for the Indiana primary.
If we win in Indiana, it's over.
And as it turned out, he was right. It's over for both Ted Cruz and John Kasich. On Tuesday, Trump won the Hoosier state with 53% of the vote, well above Cruz's 37%. And that was the final straw for Cruz, who called it quits on Tuesday night.
From the beginning, I've said that I would continue on as long as there was a viable path to victory. Tonight, I'm sorry to say, it appears that path has been foreclosed. Together, we left it all on the field in Indiana. We gave it everything we've got. But the voters chose another path. And so, with a heavy heart, but with boundless optimism for the long-term future of our nation, we are suspending our campaign.
Leading up to that, the Ted Cruz campaign had a terrible 2 weeks. The senator from Texas tried to shake things up by announcing Carly Fiorina as his vice presidential running mate, but that event was quickly eclipsed by former House Speaker John Boehner, who shared his candid opinion of Cruz while speaking at Stanford University.
Lucifer in the flesh. But I've never worked with a more miserable son of a over my dead body, will it be present?
And late Tuesday night, Republican Party Chair Reince Priebus called on the party to rally around Donald Trump, a political coup that almost no one predicted a year ago. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton's drive to the nomination seems to be on track, despite losing Indiana to Bernie Sanders by 5 percentage points, but not so fast, says Sanders.
It is virtually impossible for Secretary Clinton to reach the majority of convention delegates by June 14th with pledged delegates alone. She will need superdelegates to take her over the top at the convention in Philadelphia. In other words, the convention will be a contested contest.
Still, President Obama may have tipped the likely winner in his speech at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Next year at this time, someone else will be standing here in this very spot. And it's anyone's guess who she will be, but
before we take a guess as to who she or he will be, you can take a guess at this week's trivia question. Donald Trump's efforts in Indiana were helped by the endorsement of two former college coaches, Bobby Knight, the basketball coach at Indiana University, and Lou Holtz, who coached football at Notre Dame. So this week's question is, who was the last college sports coach elected to Congress? You can send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. Ken will select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and the winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
Can't get Indiana off my mind anywhere I chance to roam. The moonlight on the Wabash that I left behind calls me back home.
All eyes turn to Indiana this week, where both Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders hope to keep flickering hopes alive. Instead, Donald Trump won a thumping victory and forced both Cruz and John Kasich out of the race. Bernie Sanders pulled off another upset, but did not manage to cut into Hillary Clinton's lead by very much. Joining us to explain what happened is Brian Howie, the publisher of Howie Politics Indiana, a newsletter and website that illuminates the Hoosier State. Welcome.
Neil, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. We've had an exciting month here.
I bet. Well, you know, as recently as a week before this primary, it looked like it might be winnable for Ted Cruz. What happened?
Well, I mean, the Trump campaign really took on the aura of a movement. I mean, he was drawing, you know, 12,000 people in Evansville, 20,000 people in Fort Wayne. I went to a rally where he drew 10,000. I mean, it was similar to what we saw with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton in 2008. And of course, that race ended up, you know, almost 50-50. But you know, just Trump turned out these people. He didn't have a real organized ground game like Ted Cruz did. But, you know, as you traveled across the state, you saw Trump signs all over the place. We did a poll April 18th and 21, and we had the race with Trump leading 37-31. So it seemed to me like the door was cracked open for Cruz if he could wrest away some of the evangelical voters from Trump, and he didn't do it. I mean, Trump drew more than 50% of the evangelical vote this time, and he just came up short.
You know, it was not for lack of trying. Ted Cruz invested a lot of time and money and effort in what he called his firewall. Demographics that you were just talking about suggested that Indiana could be a good state for him. Was he right, do you think, that if he could not win there, there was no point in going on?
Obviously, that's the conclusion he reached. And I have to tell you, as a retail campaigner, I was impressed with Ted Cruz. I watched him, you know, plunge into crowds at Shapiro's Deli just down the block here. I watched him at the Johnson County Fairgrounds in Franklin, Indiana. The guy gives a great speech, and he, you know, really resonates with some of the Hoosier voters that I saw him come into contact with. He was impressive. The thing is that he came across a candidate like we've never seen before, Donald Trump, you know, who kind of has these rallies and doesn't really impart much policy. They're kind of stream of consciousness. He tweets. He doesn't depend on traditional campaign methods, direct mail, a lot of TV advertising. I think he was outspent on TV $6 million to $900,000 over the past couple of weeks here. And so he really came up against a phenomena that we get to watch now for the next 6 months as John Kasich has just dropped out of the race. So Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee, and we're going to be in for an amazing show coming up here.
On primary day, Donald Trump repeated a completely bogus story from the National Enquirer that Ted Cruz's father was somehow involved in the Kennedy assassination. Cruz, who, as you say, was a very disciplined campaigner, I think for the first time in this long campaign, lost it. He called Trump a pathological liar and a serial philanderer. What does that tell us about these two men?
Well, I have to say, I'm going to give you a little history here. Back in 1974, we had a congressman, a very conservative congressman named Earl Landgreeb, who was a staunch defender of President Nixon during the Watergate scandal. And at one point, as the evidence mounted against President Nixon, Earl said, "Don't confuse me with the facts." And that's the kind of candidate we've got with Donald Trump. He kind of creates an alternative universe of facts out of the ether. And to tell you the truth, I've watched hundreds, if not thousands, of Hoosier voters show up to these rallies. They latch onto his every word, and they're very much in the Earl Landgrave mode. Don't confuse me with the facts. And that's what we're seeing here. They don't matter. So, you know, last night, Donald Trump didn't need to go after Ted Cruz and his father and associate them with the JFK assassination. I mean, you want to talk about a surreal moment. Here we are in May of 2016, and Donald Trump, who had to know that he was on his way to a very comfortable, if not landslide, victory, and somehow he felt the need to tie Ted Cruz to the JFK assassination. It was just crazy. And, you know, he's citing the National Enquirer. So I think we're going to get a lot more of that. And right now, maybe the whole country's in an Earl Landgrave mode, but maybe it doesn't matter anymore. Maybe the facts don't matter.
I wish Ken were here. He'd have Earl Landgrave's high school transcript for you.
Or at least the campaign button, you know?
Yeah. Now, endorsements don't mean a lot in modern politics. I have to ask, in Indiana, Governor Mike Pence issued what had to be the most tepid endorsement of Ted Cruz I've ever heard, while Donald Trump stood on the stage with Bobby Knight and Lou Holtz. Do you think that mattered?
Well, and Gene Katie from Purdue, too. I mean, that's the coaching trifecta Hall of Fame here in Indiana. Pence's allies, the family groups, I think they've been very alarmed over the past couple of months that Trump is going to be the nominee. And what he's done is he's rendered a generation of Republican presidential politics that had a litmus test. You had to be pro-life and a fairly staunch conservative. Trump is none of those. And they watched in horror as he came to Indiana. And I think they saw, again, Indiana's that firewall that you mentioned. And so I think Governor Pence was put under great pressure to try to assist that firewall. And what he did, he came up with a very squishy endorsement. I mean, Donald Trump made fun of it on Fox News. It did not make our governor, who's in for a very tough reelection battle, to look like a decisive leader. And I think what he was trying to do is he was straddling the family groups who are, you know, very evangelical type supporters, and knowing that if Trump couldn't be stopped, he was going to have to deal with his supporters. I mean, you know, and he won in landslide fashion. So it was a classic straddle, and we'll have to see, you know, whether there are long-term implications with that, because it didn't go off very well.
On the Democratic side, the opinion polls had Secretary Clinton ahead by a few points. Senator Sanders turned that around. What do you think happened there?
Well, our pollster Gene Ohm from Public Opinion Strategies was very clear that both Sanders and Trump were kind of feeding off the same mesocyclone, political mesocyclone here, but from 180-degree vantage points. They're that far apart. You know, obviously, Sanders is much further to the left than even Trump. And so we had a lot of first-time voters. They went overwhelmingly for Trump and Sanders. And one of the things Gene told us was that the more we saw new voters coming into the process, the better the prospects were of the Sanders and Trump. So you sensed on the ground that there was some real energy behind Bernie Sanders. I was at his rally on Monument Circle right in the heart of Indiana, in Indianapolis, on Monday night. He had about 10,000 people there. Again, it had the aura of a movement. And at that point, I kind of came away convinced and was predicting that I thought Sanders had a real shot at an upset. And he did. He pulled it off. I think it was like, 53-47%?
Yeah, but when you divide the delegates proportionally, he gained what? He netted 6 delegates. Time is running out for him also. Did you see in Indiana a candidate on a glide path toward what looks like the inevitable, or a firebrand as determined as ever?
Well, what we've seen in Indiana from Trump and Sanders, again, they're feeding 180 degrees apart, but the narrative is very similar. The political and economic systems are rigged and crooked, and they're attracting a lot of people, disaffected people. We're seeing our middle class shrink over the past decade. We've seen our General Assembly and our governors sign all sorts of tax cuts for businesses and corporations and that kind of thing, and yet per capita income is falling. We've seen the Pew Research that's showing that for the first time, the middle class is now below 50%. And there's a lot of angst here in the Midwest. And Trump and Sanders are really capitalizing on that, and that's fueling their campaigns.
With all due respect for Senator Sanders, the headline has to be that Donald Trump secured the Republican nomination in Indiana. Could you have imagined that a year ago?
No, I really couldn't. You know, going back to the thunderstorm analogy, I think I wrote a column last September, October, saying, you know, this thing is like a microburst. You know, it's going to grow to 40 or 50,000 feet and then collapse, and you get a lot of hail and a lot of damage, and it's going to scatter the lawn chairs all across the backyard. And somebody like Jeb or John Kasich or Marco Rubio is going to come in, and it never happened. And what we've seen is Trump has completely eviscerated every shred of conventional wisdom. The term conventional wisdom should be banned from the rest of this election cycle. Completely meaningless.
Well, Brian Howie, thank you very much.
Neil, thanks. It's been great to be with you.
Brian Howie, publisher of the newsletter and website Howie Politics Indiana. There was another important result in the Indiana primary. Representative Todd Young won the Republican Senate nomination. He defeated fellow Congressman Marlon Stutzman. Most years, the GOP nomination would be tantamount to election in deep red Indiana. But with the Trump factor, who knows? Joining us to talk about this and a couple of other Senate races is Jennifer Duffy, senior editor at the Cook Political Report. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the primary before we get to the general. This has been described as a race that featured an establishment candidate, Mitch McConnell's choice, who turned back a Tea Party insurgent.
Well, exactly. And he not only turned him back, I mean, he beat him pretty soundly despite some resources put in by some groups like the Club for Growth, which wanted to see Stutzman in the Senate. Stutzman, though, proved to be a terrible candidate, frankly. He made a number of very big mistakes, not the least of which was trying to have Todd Young thrown off the ballot. Whatever traction he had to that point, he lost, and Young became the front runner. It's what candidate Republicans wanted, and in this environment, the candidate they need.
Yet it was a year that elsewhere has favored insurgents and outsiders.
Well, but that's not the case in Senate primaries in either party. It's very interesting. And granted, there have only been a limited number of competitive primaries on both sides in the Senate. But in both cases, the establishment has done quite well for itself. The insurgents have yet to win a contest.
Well, we'll talk about one of those races in a minute, but I want to stay on Indiana for just a moment. Come November, Todd Young will face a familiar opponent, former Democratic Representative Barron Hill. Young beat Hill in their district, their congressional district, in 2010. But 2010 was a great year for Republicans. How does the Young-Hill rematch shape up in 2016?
Well, you know, actually, in some cases for Democrats, a statewide race in Indiana is harder than a congressional district race, and especially that district, which is sort of a toss-up to begin with. But, you know, today is a day, or this week anyway, is a week where we talk about the impact Trump has on down-ballot races. And here's the most honest answer we can give you right now. We don't know. This is unprecedented. You know, his candidacy is unprecedented. If everything we know about politics is true, then yes, this is going to end up being a competitive race. The problem is nothing that we know about politics has been true in the presidential.
Well, let me ask you about one of those contested Senate primaries. A week ago Tuesday, Katie McGinty turned back former Representative Joe Sestak for the Democratic Senate nomination in Pennsylvania. She will face incumbent Republican Pat Toomey. He's considered vulnerable. She may lack experience, but then there's the Trump factor. She's already said she's going to be running against what she called a Toomey-Trump bigotry ticket.
Yeah, I've heard that, a similar sentiment from most Democrats running in competitive Senate races. I think that they are going to do that. I think that states like Pennsylvania, where, you know, Democrats have carried it in the presidential for the last few elections, you know, those are far more problematic in the world of Trump than a state like Indiana. So, yeah, I'd say that Toomey is in trouble, as is Senator Portman in Ohio, Senator Ayotte in New Hampshire, Senator Johnson in Wisconsin. Those races we have in toss-up, you know, you're dealing with incumbents who are really going to have to find their way around Trump without alienating their base.
Again, very early days, but can you think of a Senate race where Trump would help the Republican nominee?
Well, you know, I've had Republican pollsters argue that to some degree, you know, he might help a little bit in an Ohio, in a Wisconsin, if you're looking at, you know, a certain demographic of white voter, a white male working class voter who came out to support Trump strongly and may do that for Senate candidates. But I'll go back to my original statement. We don't know.
Only minutes after Ted Cruz suspended his campaign, prognosticators had general election maps up, and most believe that Donald Trump is going to need to put Pennsylvania in play if he hopes to win. Senator Toomey would need those Trump voters, but you know, Senator Toomey disagrees with him on so much. The Club for Growth, for example, is a big part of the Never Trump movement. Pat Toomey was president of the Club for Growth. How does he manage that divide?
That, you know, that is a good question. It's one that Republicans are struggling with. But I think you're going to hear statements like, I disagree with Trump on many things. I don't really like his tone or his attitude, but he's better than the alternative. I think that there are only a few Republican incumbents who can actually walk away from Trump, and that is somebody like a Mark Kirk in Illinois, you know, who's got, you know, a pretty tough road. But you really run the risk of alienating the base to absolutely walk away from him. So all of these Senate incumbents are going to have to find some happy medium, and that is a tough thing.
I wanted to ask you about another Senate incumbent before we let you go, and that's John McCain, who, of course, was the Republican presidential candidate just 8 years ago. He faces a tough primary opponent come August, and polls suggest that if he wins that, he'll face a tough general election against Democrat Ann Kirkpatrick. The primary first, his opponent is State Senator Kelly Ward, who is challenging him from the right, he would say from the far right.
First of all, McCain is no stranger to primary challenges. He actually has two opponents, which helps him a great deal. And frankly, Kelly Ward hasn't really been able to get the support in the Tea Party community she needs to beat him. So a three-way primary helps McCain. There's a bit of a pattern here for McCain that I've noticed in his last couple of races. As long as he's got a primary, his general election numbers tend to sag a bit. Once the primary is over and he's the nominee, it seems like everybody's, you know, back on board and he opens a bit of a lead. I expect that's going to be the case here. And if there's anybody who will successfully distance themselves from Trump, it will be John McCain. I think that he's a very skillful politician. But certainly that's one of the races I'm watching closely. I mean, I have a tier one of races, really the races in our toss-up column. I have a tier two, and that's where I put states like North Carolina, Indiana, Arizona.
Okay. John McCain, we mentioned Trump, said he would vote for the Republican nominee, whoever that is, but clearly holding Trump at arm's length, at least arm's length. He originally supported his friend Lindsey Graham, told Arizona voters before the presidential primary to think long and hard before they vote for Trump. And just the other day, his longtime aide, Mark Salter, a man many consider his alter ego, came out and tweeted that he is for Hillary Clinton. McCain is in a tight spot.
Well, true. Let me ask you this. I saw that comment from Mark Salter, and I absolutely believe him. But do you think that he's going to vote for any other Democrat on the ballot?
No.
I doubt it. I mean, one of the things that we could see here is the return of the split-ticket voter. which would be fascinating since we haven't seen them in in a couple of decades. But you may see that. Republicans' biggest concern is voters who don't want to vote for either candidate and stay home. They have to convince those voters that the Senate majority, which was in play before Trump won the nomination, is worth coming out to vote for. I mean, it's a tough job. They got to do it, though, if they have any hope of keeping their losses to a minimum. I think it's very tough to keep their majority, but they need to keep those losses to a minimum.
Because in 2 years, the calendar flips, and it looks like the Democrats will have a tough time.
Well, exactly. In 2 years, there will be 25 Democratic seats up and only 8 Republicans.
Let me ask you, though, that seems to put a lot of focus on two figures everybody's going to be watching very carefully, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and, of course, Paul Ryan, not only Speaker of the House, but the man who's going to be holding the gavel in Cleveland when the convention gets underway.
Well, exactly. Several months ago, I think Trump said that it would be in Paul Ryan's best interest to get along with him, and if he didn't, they would have problems. I hope that somebody has explained to Trump at this point that really, no, it's probably in Trump's best interest that they get along, because it's hard to sign legislation that doesn't land on your desk. As far as McConnell goes, look, he is very committed to keeping as many Senate seats as he can. You know, they've started under the auspices of American Crossroads a Senate-dedicated super PAC. I think you're going to see one or two more pop up in the foreseeable future. And you're going to see a lot of smart money on the Republican side move into those super PACs to be dedicated to keeping the Senate.
Well, Jennifer Duffy, senior editor with the Cook Political Report, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Neil.
It's time for This Week in Political History, and we go back to May 1st, 2011, perhaps the most dramatic moment of the Obama presidency.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children.
The raid that killed Osama bin Laden was the bookend of the decade that began on 9/11, 10 years that included the overthrow of the Taliban government in Afghanistan and the American-led invasion of Iraq. Al-Qaeda staged major attacks in Madrid and London and set up affiliates in many countries around the world, one of them metastasized into the organization we now call the Islamic State. So while the war with Islamic extremists continues, the bin Laden mission marks an important moment. To learn more about what happened and what it means, we turn to Mark Bowden, who wrote The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. He's probably best known for Black Hawk Down. His most recent book is The Three Battles of Wanat and Other True Stories. He's also a writer in residence at the University of Delaware. Mark Bowden, nice to talk to you again.
Thank you, Neil.
Where were you on that Sunday night 5 years ago?
I was sitting in my cousin's house in Hermosa Beach in Los Angeles, and watching a Phillies-Mets game, and was interrupted by the president's message.
Pretty dramatic moment.
It was very exciting. You know, you remember, I do, you know, certain moments in my life that have reached me through television, the killing of John F. Kennedy, for one, the blowing up of the space shuttle, the, you know, certain events that really stay with you, and this is one of them.
I want to get into the mission itself. Our focus, though, on this program is politics. So let me ask you about the political effect. How important was the raid to the re-election and ultimately to the legacy of Barack Obama?
I think it was very important. You know, it certainly was intelligence and military triumph that happened on his watch. I think that Obama probably was vulnerable to more conservative, more militaristic criticism for being someone who prefers diplomacy to military action. And I think he had pulled the United States, or was in the process of pulling the United States out of Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think the killing of bin Laden shored up his credentials as a commander-in-chief probably more than any other single thing he could have done.
And it was that quote that Joe Biden liked to use often during the campaign. If you think Barack Obama is weak, ask Osama bin Laden.
Right. I mean, it's a note that they struck frequently. And I think they did it knowing how important that event was. And it really was an important event. I think that, you know, the killing of bin Laden was an extremely powerful message sent by the United States. It was a symbolic victory, and symbolic victories matter a great deal.
I don't know if you saw the CNN special the other night that Peter Bergen did. He included an interview with Admiral McRaven, who was, of course, then the head of U.S. Special Operations Forces, the man who commanded the raid. And he said that, you know, in the run-up to it, he never heard a single mention of politics. Is that your understanding?
It is. I think that Obama had made getting bin Laden a priority of his administration even before he was elected. He was famously criticized in a debate for saying that he would launch a military raid into Pakistan if there were al-Qaeda targets available, even without asking the permission of Pakistan. And people like Hillary Clinton and others jumped all over him for that, saying how irresponsible it was. But he meant it.
Naive, I think, was her word, yeah.
Yeah. And he meant it, and when he was given the opportunity, he acted on it. And so I think, you know, I don't think there was a great deal of political calculation here. I think that you could argue that this was very much Obama's stated policy, and he followed through on it.
Of course, the dramatic pictures from the Situation Room that night include then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and I expect we're going to see and hear a lot more about that over the next 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, she and the president and the key people of Vice President Biden and others in his Security Council were meeting in the Situation Room while that raid took place, but they had made a decision not to include a video feed in the Situation Room itself. But at a certain point, the president just decided he could not do without a video feed of this raid in operation. And there was one on the wall in a room adjacent to the Situation Room. So they all ended up piling into that small room because they wanted to watch it unfold.
And Admiral McRaven was doing play-by-play.
He was. He was in Jalalabad, and he was the commander of the mission. But he was linked to Leon Panetta at CIA. And I don't think that McRaven wasn't speaking directly to the people in the room, but he was on a telecommunications link that was being monitored by a military officer in that room. He's the guy sitting in front of his laptop in that picture.
Mm-hmm. In retrospect, do you think it's fair to describe the decision to go or not as 50-50?
Well, that's what the people who made the decision characterize it as, and I take them at their word. You know, some would put the odds even less. It was really Obama listening to such a broad range of estimates, everything from it's a slam dunk to it's like a 20% chance of success, ultimately just said what this amounts to is it's 50-50. And I think that's a fair characterization. They weren't sure that bin Laden was really there, and they weren't certain that they were going to be able to get in and out of Pakistan without alerting Pakistan's defenses, which would have created a much, much bigger problem.
And the other thought that had to be in their mind was Desert One. Of course, the debacle, the failed mission to rescue the American hostages in Tehran, and ultimately led to the loss in the presidential election for Jimmy Carter.
That's right. And there were people involved in this decision, Bob Gates, for one, who were around the Carter administration and the military when Desert One happened. So this was in their vividly remembered moment. And like the raid into Iran to try to rescue the hostages, this involved projecting helicopters across a great distance stealthily and inserting a special operations force to conduct a raid and then getting them out of the country secretly. And I think, you know, what Desert One illustrated was when you've got that many moving parts, it's very, very difficult to predict everything will function smoothly.
You and others have, of course, written that in a lot of ways, the American Special Forces, the SEAL teams and Delta, and especially the helicopter operators, were all reshaped after Desert One specifically for this kind of a mission.
That's right. You know, when President Carter asked the military what kind of a mission they could put together to rescue the hostages, they really lacked the capability of doing anything like that. They cobbled together a mission borrowing from parts, basically, from all the different branches, and they threw together a kind of a Rube Goldberg-esque mission. And I think that the failure of that mission illustrated to the Carter administration that the United States needed a far more sophisticated special operations capability. And that evolved then ever since. And I think, you know, what the great advantage in 2011 was for the military was that they had been at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they had a well-honed teams of pilots, special operators, technicians who had been doing missions exactly like this nightly for a decade. And so these were arguably the best trained people in history to conduct a mission like this.
By the time he was killed, how important was Osama bin Laden?
Well, he remained tremendously important on a number of levels. He was, you know, probably most important as a symbolic leader of the sort of radical Islam, and he had become a symbol of that movement around the world. And I think he was also still at trying to the best of his ability to manage his own conception of al-Qaeda, even as it was morphing into other things out from under him. He was able, through hand-carried letters, to communicate with his top lieutenants. And what you see when you read his correspondence in his final months holed up in Abbottabad is someone still very actively managing his organization.
Since your book came out, there's been a flood of other material, books by some of the Navy SEALs, for example. Has any of that changed our basic understanding of what happened that night in Abbottabad?
No, nothing has. You know, the books that have been written by the individual SEALs who went on the raid have had some minor discrepancies. They argue in particular about which SEAL in line happened to be the one to actually kill bin Laden. But, you know, the overall account of the mission has stayed pretty much the same. There haven't been any surprises to my knowledge, you know, since I wrote my book.
The major challenge to the story you and others tell is the piece by Seymour Hersh that, in capsule, says the raid was military theater. The tip wasn't the famous tracking of bin Laden's courier, but a Pakistani walk-in. The Pakistanis were in on the raid. Now, of course, Seymour Hersh is the reporter who broke the My Lai massacre, among other stories. He deserves a great deal of respect. How do you value his version of events?
Well, I think Seymour is just wrong about this. You know, and I've said, when asked about it, you know, I can't really account for why Seymour puts so much credence in the version of events that he's been told by his two anonymous sources. You know, all I know is that I approach my reporting the same way I always have, which is to go to the people directly involved and interview as many of them as I can, in this case, scores of them. It strains credulity to me to believe that everyone from the President of the United States to the individual SEALs who went on the raid are all somehow collaborating in a massive lie to the American people. I can't really explain why Seymour takes this seriously, but he does, and therefore a lot of other people do, and I guess we all just have to live with it. I think that any account that debunks or attempts to debunk the story of how bin Laden was found and killed is really an insult to the people who conducted the incredible intelligence effort over a decade to find bin Laden, and also the men who risked their lives to go on this mission, to say nothing of the commanders who made very difficult decisions in the White House and at CIA. You know, it seems to me this was an extraordinary intelligence triumph and a tremendously successful military operation. And to somehow say that all of these people who were successful are making it up, it just seems to me, without a shred of evidence, just insulting.
Al-Qaeda has not gone away, but seems considerably diminished, certainly by way of comparison with ISIS. In a couple of places, irony of ironies, the U.S. and Al-Qaeda affiliates find themselves on the same side. In Yemen, for example, both oppose the Houthi rebels. That's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In Syria, the Nusra Front is often intertwined with U.S.-backed rebels. Is Al-Qaeda in any sense becoming acceptable?
Well, everything changes. Certainly the Al-Qaeda that was responsible for the raid on 9/11 in the United States is no longer in existence for all practical purposes. I think what is true is that Osama bin Laden and his organization were a reflection or a product of a much larger kind of cultural, religious movement in the Middle East. And I think that bin Laden certainly helped to define the tactics and goals of that movement. But I think, you know, what you see with ISIS and other radical Islamic movements is a more general rebellion against modernity, against Western values, and in many cases against the political architecture of the Middle East. So, you know, bin Laden was one thing, and he also, I think, was a reflection of a bigger thing.
Mark Bowden, thanks very much.
Oh, you're very welcome, Neil.
Mark Bowden is the author of The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. His most recent book is The Three Battles of Wanat and Other True Stories. It was 5 years ago this week that President Obama announced that American forces had found and killed Osama bin Laden. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, before Donna Edwards this year in Maryland, who was the last black female member of Congress to run for the United States Senate? The answer is Denise Majette of Georgia. Majette, who unseated the controversial Cynthia McKinney in 2002, decided to run for the Senate seat that was being vacated by Zell Miller in 2004. She won the Democratic nomination, but lost in a landslide to Republican Johnny Isaacson. And the winner is Federico Delgado of Miami, Florida. Congratulations. Federico wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, Ken still has a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political columns, trivia questions, and so much more on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. On the last day in April, President Obama took his last turn before the annual gathering of the White House Correspondents Association, a once obscure event that's now broadcast live and analyzed just as closely as the State of the Union. What did the president joke about? Who were his targets? And most important of all, was he funny? For much of the Obama administration, it was David Litt's job to make sure the president killed, as the comics would say. Litt left his job as a speechwriter at the White House to write a book about that experience. He's also head writer and producer for Funny or Die DC and joins us from the studios of WAMU in Washington. Thanks very much for coming in.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here.
Your old boss got pretty good reviews. What was it like to watch when you didn't know what was coming?
Well, it was fun. You know, I had an inkling of what there would be, but I didn't know every joke that would be in the speech. And so this was the first year in several years where I got to just enjoy it. And I thought he did great.
Professionals give him a lot of credit for good timing. I wonder, do you think his skill as an orator, and, you know, the president sure knows how to work a crowd, do you think that skill translates to comedy?
Well, it doesn't always translate for everybody, but I think in this president's case, it certainly does. You know, it's that sense of audience that is true if he's giving a college commencement or a big political rally. That serves him well when he's telling jokes. He has that sense of when the room is ready for that punchline, when they're going to respond well to something that kind of tags a joke with an extra line. And he did that a lot on Saturday night.
Could you identify who wrote the jokes as you heard them?
No, I mean, you know, fundamentally, a lot of different people work on these jokes. This year, the process was run by one of my former colleagues, Tyler Lechtenberg, who did a great job. The truth is, the jokes ultimately are the president's, and that's not just because he's delivering them, but he's putting his own spin on them. All of them have been edited by him, and really, the delivery makes or breaks a joke like that. And so every joke really ends up being one of his, not just because he was in the room deciding which ones go into the speech and which ones don't.
Was there one line that stood out for you?
You know, there were a couple. I think to me, the most fun part was the video they showed at the end where John Boehner came in and did a cameo. I thought that was fun. And it was also just a reminder that in this crazy political season, you know, we just don't see a lot of Republicans and Democrats being able to come together and take the gloves off for a night. So that was fun to watch.
Who would have thought that John Boehner and Barack Obama would make up a double act?
Yeah, that's right. They're quite a duo, it turns out.
There was a bit from last year that I wanted to ask you about, the president's bucket list.
I am determined to make the most of every moment I have left. After the midterm elections, my advisors asked me, Mr. President, do you have a bucket list? And I said, well, I have something that rhymes with bucket list.
Why did that bit work so well?
Well, I think it's two things. One was, you know, that was a little bit edgy for a president, you know, not necessarily edgy for a professional comic, but the president saying he had something that rhymes with bucket is not something that he might have said in the very first year of his presidency. And then the second thing is that it fit really nicely with the moment. So that was a time when the president was entering the fourth quarter. He was taking executive action. He was making it clear that he still wanted to get things done. And that joke encapsulated that in a funny way.
And it really spoke to the truth that underlay the joke.
Exactly. I think that's one of the things these jokes don't always do, but something they can do is get at a truth in a way you couldn't normally in politics, using a different tone.
Obviously, because he's president, a lot of material is out of bounds. As you just suggested, the president can't work blue. But are some jokes funnier because it's the president?
Well, I think that's part of any joke that the president is telling. Part of what makes it funny is that the president is the one telling the joke. For the joke writers, that ends up being something that we're always thinking about. Is it something that is funnier because the president is saying it, as opposed to a comic like, you know, Samantha Bee or John Oliver or somebody else who does a lot of political comedy?
It must be daunting to pitch the president of the United States.
It is daunting. The good news is when he laughs and responds well to something, that feels really good because you're also getting a good response from the president of the United States. But there have certainly been more than one occasion where he'll, you know, have given me kind of a puzzled look that suggests maybe something is not quite as funny as I thought. And that can be a scary moment when you're sitting in the Oval Office.
I bet. And of course, everybody, you know, really wants him to be funny, expects him to be funny, but he really can't afford to bomb.
Right. I mean, I think the truth is, if you're writing a normal speech for the president, and that's most of what I did at the White House was write all the other types of speeches the president gives, along with, you know, the whole team of speechwriters. If you write an applause line and no one applauds, no one really notices. If you write a joke and nobody laughs,
everybody notices.
Yeah. The entire room is suddenly not having fun. And so the stakes are, you know, they're not higher in a geopolitical sense, but in a rhetorical sense, you know whether or not it's working.
Describe the process. How do you go about, you know, assembling? It's obviously, as you said, it's not just you. There's a lot of people who contribute.
Yeah. So usually it's a process that takes anywhere between 3 and 4 weeks. There's a list of topics that will go out to a variety of joke writers. So that's everybody from the speechwriters in the White House, who are led by the chief speechwriter, Cody Keenan, former speechwriters, people like David Axelrod or Jon Favreau, Jon Lovett. And then you have a number of professional comedy writers who have been writing, some for 1 year, some for, you know, 4 or 5 years, who usually are pretty discreet about it, which we appreciate, and don't mind volunteering their services. And so between all of those people, you end up with several hundred jokes. And of those, maybe 40 or 50 go to the president, and he'll decide which ones he likes, which ones he wants to keep. He'll often push the writers to make those jokes a little bit sharper if he thinks they're not quite good enough. And then from that initial list of hundreds, you end up with 30, 35, maybe 40 in the final speech.
Some people might wonder at all the work and time that goes into this. They might say, you know, surely the president of the United States and even his speechwriters have more important things to do. Why devote all the time and effort to jokes?
Well, I should say, I thought when I was at the White House very much about that question of the president's time. I mean, you know, my time was not that valuable. The president's time is infinitely valuable. So you want to do as much of the work as possible where he's not forced to be engaged with it. You know, he does get involved, but he's not taking 3 weeks to think about this. And that was an important thing for me and for the other speechwriters. I think, you know, in general, it's something that every year the president is expected to do. And like anything, you want it to go well. Jokes can take a little bit more time than other speeches. And the other thing I will say is while there are certainly, you know, the Correspondents' Dinner, as you mentioned, has gone from this very small closed press sort of event to this much bigger one, there is something kind of nice about the idea that the president of the United States is publicly pointing out that he may take his job very seriously, but he doesn't take himself too seriously. I think there's almost something democratic about that.
It's also, as you pointed out, you wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and you pointed out that, you know, the bully pulpit isn't really there anymore. The president has to find new ways to communicate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, there are still moments when the entire nation will watch a presidential speech, but those moments are less frequent than they were even 8 years ago and certainly, you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
And the State of the Union, for example, is nowhere near as important as it used to be.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that the State of the Union, it still gets, you know, tens of millions. I think this year was over 30 million viewers. It's still a speech that the White House takes incredibly seriously. But that notion that everyone is watching on that night, part of it is you can watch the State of the Union any night you feel like watching it. You just look it up on Facebook or YouTube. And so it's not just that each individual speech, the urgency has changed a little bit, especially now that everything's online.
And if the president wants to send a message, he can do that maybe even more effectively than in a press release if he goes on, you know, between two ferns.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, certain things, I think, particularly now lend themselves to comedy. And one of them is one where you're trying to drive people to take an action, especially when those people are younger and tend to get their information on the internet. So you mentioned between two ferns, when healthcare.gov was initially launched and it wasn't working very well, and we needed to let young people know the website is working and it's worth going to, a traditional speech probably would not have worked as well as getting the president to appear with Zach Galifianakis and, in between some jokes, make a real pitch to get people to go to the site. And as we saw, that worked.
Earlier, we spoke with Mark Bowden about the five-year anniversary of the bin Laden raid. The mission was being debated at the White House at the same time you and the other speechwriters were nailing down the president's speech to the Correspondents' Association. It might sound incongruous, but both were happening in the same time frame. Now, obviously, you did not know what was going on in the Situation Room, but you have told a story about a joke that the president edited that year about one of the Republicans who was running for president.
Yeah, well, that dinner, I had been at the White House for about 3 or 4 weeks, so I wasn't in the Oval Office meetings. I had sent some jokes in to John Lovett, who was running the process that year. I knew that they were bringing them into the Oval, and one of those jokes included bin Laden as part of the punchline. And then when we saw the next draft that went around over email, that bin Laden had been changed to, I think it was Hosni, after Hosni Mubarak, the former Egyptian president.
At the time, he was still the president of Egypt, but yeah. The joke, at least as I read about it in a piece in the Los Angeles Times, was about one of the Republican presidential candidates that year, Tim Pawlenty, and his real name, and this is a riff on the old birth certificate thing.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was, it sounds all American, but, you know, his real name, Tim Bin Laden Pawlenty, which, you know, I thought I was very excited was going to be in the speech. And then I saw it got edited and was very confused because I thought that my way of writing it, not to toot my own horn, but I was like, I think I did this pretty well. And then the next night when all of America realized what had happened, I suddenly understood why the president had changed that joke.
Because he couldn't make a joke about bin Laden as he was deciding to kill him.
Well, one of the interesting things is that, you know, you go back and watch the 2011 remarks, not just the president's, but Seth Meyers, who did that was a great monologue he delivered that year. And he made a joke about where bin Laden was hiding. And if you watch the president laugh, even now, he does not betray a single sign that he knows that something big is about to happen. It was pretty remarkable.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Former White House speechwriter David Litt, head writer and producer for Funny or Die DC. He wrote about his experience writing jokes for the president in an op-ed in the New York Times, and it's also going to be the subject of a forthcoming book. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt and puzzles, and bad jokes, and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin Junkie or follow the show on Facebook. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Ken Rudin, who's looking forward to being back with you next week. Thanks for listening.